IVM.
Hello and welcome to the Ganatantra podcast. I am Sariu Natarajan.
And I'm Alok Prasannakumar.
And in this week's episode, we have Dr. Chinmay Tumbe with us. Chinmay is passionate about migration, cities and history and is currently a faculty member at the Indian Institute of Management, Ahmedabad, an alumnus of the London School of Economics and Political Science, the Indian Institute of Management, Bangalore, Ruya College, Mumbai and Rishi Valley School, Madanapalli. He has been a faculty member at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences, Hyderabad. He was a 2013 Jean Monnet Fellow at the Migration Policy Center, European University Institute, Florence, and the 2018 Alfred D. Chandler Jr. International Visiting Scholar in Business History at Harvard Business School. He has published widely on migration for over a decade and has served on several policymaking groups. And we're here to discuss his work on migration and his book, India Moving.
Welcome to the podcast, Chinmay.
Thank you for having me over.
Great. So let's kick off and probably give our listeners a brief overview of what you cover in your book and perhaps give them like a 2-minute summary. And that's probably asking too much of a very exhaustive book, but perhaps what your central argument in the book was and what prompted you to write this book?
Sure. Migration is a fascinating topic. Various aspects of migration and what prompted me to write this book, that there was simply no book out there which told you about different kinds of migrations related with India in one place. So this is in a way the first book that talks about both internal migration and international migration related with the Indian subcontinent. It talks about voluntary and involuntary migrations. And it talks about not only the migration of labor, but also the migration of capital. And so different chapters of this book sort of convey this history. While it's a history of migration, the first chapter takes you through a history of millenniums. But the bulk of the book is really the history of the last 500 years, for which we have more information on migration. And then for the last 200 years, we have even more information on migration. And the central argument of the book is that India is sort of unique in sort of sustaining both large volumes of internal migration, emigration, and immigration, all three at the same time. We have kind of been through a phase which is ongoing of what I call the Great Indian Migration Wave, which I argue is the world's largest and longest voluntary migration system that started from the late 19th century and still exists today in various parts of India, like the coastal belts, like Bihar, Eastern UP, and many other parts of India, where people, usually men, migrate for not permanently, but they migrate for semi-permanent durations, spend many times their lifetime outside, but then they retire back home in their villages or towns in the source region. And this is happening with regular periodicity. And so a chapter of the book looks at that. But there are other chapters which looks at the migration of business communities, like the Marwadis, the Parsis, and there's a chapter on involuntary migration. And the book ends really with a chapter on migration and development, given how big a theme migration has become today in India's political history.
Absolutely. In fact, I started out my PhD wanting to research migration and political participation in urban areas. And I know the paucity of literature on the topic. And I think your book came at the time that I was submitting my thesis. So, thank you for writing this book and thank you for this wonderful overview as well. But getting into some of the components of migration, particularly in the context of what we've been thinking about in terms of marginalization in this podcast, one of the questions I'd like to answer or understand before we get into discussing marginalization a little bit more is that of gender and the centrality of gender in thinking about migration, whether it is the seasonal migration around sort of circulating kind of migration or more longer term migration that women do, particularly in the context of marriage. So, would love to understand if there was some more nuance we could add to how we think about gender and migration.
Yeah, the first thing to recognize is that virtually every Indian woman, especially and every adult Indian woman, is a migrant. Because upon marriage, in most parts of India, you have strict village exogamy, which means you move, you change your village upon marriage. It doesn't happen in some parts of India, but in most parts it does. Which means automatically the Census of India reports, literally more than 300 million female migrants in India, and that's because of when you move upon marriage, you're classified as a migrant. Now, while women move, these are mostly short distance migrations. Though in some parts of India, like where you have skewed sex ratios at birth in Punjab, Haryana, you also have bridal migration. So there's a lot of movement from Bengal and Bihar. These are called, brides being imported into Haryana and Punjab to clear the marriage markets, so as to speak, because there's a sort of excess supply of men. And so there's a dearth of women in that particular region, which means these marriage migrations can also be for large distances. Now, coming to your point of, marginalization, I think throughout Indian history, one has to recognize that often people think that migration or clauses restricting migration started with the visa system, started with the passport system recently. But one of the things I found out in my research was that throughout history, there have been important social and cultural norms restricting or governing mobility. And since you are specifically on women, there are sort of general norms inscribed in a variety of texts about what women can and cannot do and where women can move and when they cannot move. And so classically, in the Arthashastra, for example, compiled at least 1800 years ago, a clear description of when a woman can move. For example, a woman cannot leave the house when the husband is asleep or drunk, but she can go, of course, during childbirth, go back to her native place. She can go to support leaders in the war, etc., etc. So this idea that women can move anywhere and everywhere, one needs to question that, because throughout history there's been some restrictions. Having said that, today in India, the fundamental form of work-related mobility is male-dominated, which means, whether it's people working in Mumbai, whether it's people working in Surat, or whether it's people, Indians working in the Gulf, in the Persian Gulf countries, this labor migration stream is almost overwhelmingly male-dominated, which means the women are left behind. Now, one aspect is, what happens to women left behind? Do they get more autonomy? Do they get more freedom? And research shows that it's very mixed. My assessment is that not much changes, because the women are still there within the larger family setup. But when women get complete autonomy, that is, they're in nuclear households and the husband leaves, then they automatically get a lot of power, because they're the sort of boss of the household. And that's when suddenly you see some changes. Women start going out, making more transactions in marketplaces, etc. And that's when, some semblance of autonomy. And some research has sort of shown that women in nuclear households do much better when men leave than when women are in joint family systems. Now, what happens to women when they come to the destination region? It's linked with labor markets in India. And so we know in India, we have one of the lowest female workforce participation rates in cities, female workforce meaning paid work. And so as a result, even if you marry and you come to a city from another city or another village, it's very unlikely that you're going to work outside. Right, so your work is basically within the house and it's unpaid labor. And that's a huge issue, because in India, it's only 10 to 15% of women who are working in cities outside. And it's one of the lowest numbers in the world. To give you some comparison, China, it's more than 50%. So when you talk of migrants, most women that you're going to see in the city are actually migrants, but most of them are actually not working. And many of them could have been working in villages, doing some tasks or the other. But in cities, that space seems to be completely constrained. And I sort of argue in this book that part of the reason is how cities were themselves formed. Because cities were formed in India, many cities were formed through massive male migration that sort of created these male networks in residential areas, in occupation, which automatically restricted women. So as the women started coming to cities, the major cities like Bombay or Delhi and so on, the spaces were anyway to work outside the home were quite restricted. So these are some of the ways in which when the other way, of course, is highly educated women who go to the U.S., for example, on dependent visas. Many of them, of course, go to work. But we know that for a fact that about 100,000 Indians are on the dependent visa, and most of them are women. And so this is a unique form of brain drain, where people are going out, highly educated women, but cannot work because they think that they will eventually get work. But the visa laws are very strict. And so you get locked out of the labor market even when you want to participate in it. So there, of course, you have a clear visa regulation, blocking your participation. But in internal migration, there are social norms, for example, which restrict.
And that's a fascinating thing about how in terms of how migration sort of affects women's job prospects and so on. And I think this is a very interesting explanation that you give, because a lot of people have been grappling with this issue. Why is India's female labor force participation falling? And perhaps the nature of the migration, that it was male dominated, relied on certain networks, was perhaps what was the reason for it. And that's a very interesting thing to think about in this context. But I was, while you were just mentioning, I was thinking of two, I don't know how massive it is, and probably you have the better data for this, but two almost women-dominated streams of migration which seem to have happened in the last generation or so. One is out of Kerala. A lot of women as nurses, as caregivers, not just to the Gulf, but also to the rest of India and everywhere else around the world, we have seen quite, and that has been feminized in a certain sense. The other is, say, the movement of women from the northeast of the country to urban areas, also in some in form of caregiving work, including, say, popularly for spas and for hairdressing and so on. A lot of service professions, broadly. I wonder if this is a phenomenon that has been studied to some extent.
Yeah, that's a good observation, and it actually has been studied. I do mention the Malayali nurses in the book. In fact, today, you know, I mean, marriage prospects are hugely enhanced for Malayali women, just if they're given some basic exams, you know, in the nursing profession, because, and this is a sort of reverse case. Earlier, it was the men, you know, if they had a U.S. visa stamp, that increased your prospects in the job market. Now you're seeing it for women. So there's no doubt. And these networks started first within India, mainly Delhi, and then, you know, spread across India, and then, of course, around the world. And so the global Malayali nurse or caregiver, a huge concentration around Rome, by the way, in Italy, of Malayali nurses. Partly because of Christianity as, you know, a common link. It's also interesting as to, you know, which, I mean, there's a lot of research on this by, you know, important scholars who work in this field. But one of the interesting things is about, you know, who got into this profession first, and it's mainly the Christians. And one of the reasons why Hindus apparently did not enter this profession was precisely because of taboos on untouchability, on purity and so on. And nursing is a very hands-on, personalized care work, which means you need to touch, you know, wounds, etc., which earlier, you know, were restricted for certain social groups. And so it's not surprising that this actually started among Christian women. So when you say Malayali women, it's actually mainly Malayali Christian women, and it's their networks which is, you know, spread. But having said that, we have clear data on Kerala migration statistics. And so what you're talking about is a significant phenomenon with complete feminization of the nursing profession. But in the overall statistics of Kerala, just males completely dominate women in out-migration streams. So the overall overall number for Kerala is still that Kerala sends many more men. I mean, something like 80% of the outflow is men. But what the observation is right, that there are these professions where, again, networks are very important. And so an entire profession gets quickly sort of feminized in that way. The other part is the Northeast sort of story. And there you see a similar thing. There, of course, it's slightly different. There are very good English skills, which are highly valued in the market. So it's a variety of things. It's also in the restaurant sector, but it's also in care. But unlike the Malayali nurse phenomenon, which you see across cities, across the world, what you're seeing is a much more recent phenomenon from the Northeast. And so it's really restricted to, you know, Bombay, actually Delhi and Bangalore, which are the biggest hubs. And so there have been some studies on this phenomenon. And again, these are networks. So that is why you're going to see very few of them in Jaipur or, you know, other of the top 10 cities of India. It's mainly Delhi.
I know that's true.
And that's true. And just before, because of the Malayali nurse thing, I can, a small anecdote about how this has changed the profession. Someone in my family was recently in the hospital, and he overheard his nurse speaking in Malayalam, and he knows a bit of Malayalam. So he asked where in Kerala she was from, and she replied, "No, I'm from Hassan," and which is in Karnataka. And he was like, "Then how do you know Malayalam so well?" And she's like, "No, because every other nurse in this hospital is Malayali speaking, and I've learned it from them." So in a sense, it seems like the default lingua franca of the profession is becoming Malayalam. But yeah,
absolutely. I mean, you know, I work in the economics profession, right. And the joke out here, which is actually also in the book, is that you need to know three languages to succeed in economics in India, and that's English, maths, and Bengali. You know, we've got yet another Bengali Nobel Prize winner in this field. And it's a strong network even out there. And so the joke is like, you know, like the Kannadiga woman learning Malayali. If only I knew Bengali, you know, my prospects would be
much better. Doesn't seem to be too bad right now, though, Chinmay. Into another sort of stream of thought in terms of push-based migration, one of the big explanations conditions in some ways around migration has been climate change or climatic conditions, drought, which push farmers, particularly in rural areas, into cities. How do we think about that, both from the historical perspective and in a more contemporary way? Because there's implications for the polity as well in how we think about this kind of migration. And you do talk about a little bit of this in your book as well. And we'd love to hear a little more about, you know, how do you understand push migration in a historical sense and also in the contemporary?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first thing that any migration researcher will tell you is, you know, it takes two blades of a scissor to cut. So when we say push and pull in migration, it's never just a push, there's also a pull. I mean, you could have a drought and no migration if there are no opportunities outside. So it's only when, for example, in history, you had the great famines of the late 19th century. Now, these famines were all across India, but only in some places, like some districts close to the coast of Tamil Nadu, that migration networks began, because they had access to the plantations in Malaysia and Sri Lanka. And that's where the mass migration stream started. So it was a massive shock of famine, which drove people. But the same famine in Mysore, the same famine in, you know, what we would call as Maharashtra today, Eastern Maharashtra, didn't really lead to much out migration. So you need that pull factor as well. Now, in contemporary India, I think there have been a lot of farmers' crises. But what's interesting is that if you look at the geography of out-migration today, and if you look at the geography of farmer distress, it is not as perfectly correlated as you would think. So you would find a lot of, yes, you know, when a drought is really bad in Vidarbha, you would see some out-migration. But Vidarbha's out-migration rates are some of the lowest in India. And we know that from every data point on agriculture, that Vidarbha has not really been, you know, a great success story in agriculture. So it's a bit mixed. I mean, the point I'm trying to say is that in order to migrate, you need some networks. These networks could have started from a push factor like a famine or a flood, like in the case of Udupi migrations and so on. But over time, the networks are very solid. And then the network is important because then what happens, for example, the classic case being Ganjam, where a cyclone has battered this region for literally every once in 10 years, and where migration then becomes actually a very stable strategy. So at one point, it might have been a shock, but after a point, it becomes actually a sustainable strategy because you know that you're going to keep getting these climatic sort of shocks again and again. Now, that is, of course, climatic shocks. You can also have man-made disasters with policy errors, or, you know, certain things go completely wrong, or fertilizers messing around with groundwater, for example. And of course, you get some localized out-migration. But what's interesting for me as a researcher is that, and this is obviously a question I get asked a fair amount, that is, what is the relationship between distress, rural distress, and out-migration? And it's not as clear-cut as you think. That is, yes, when there's acute distress, people will start to search around. But the minute that distress goes around the next year, they're still there. Whereas in some places, distress or no distress, people are going out, irrespective, right? So Eastern UP being the classic case. Yes, they have floods. If you ask a person in Bombay, they'll say, you know, one of the reasons I'm in Bombay is it keeps flooding in Eastern UP. But the point is, it's a long network which has been established. And so that push has been combined with that pull, making it a stable sort of migration strategy. Whereas in Vidarbha, even today, you'd be surprised to know that, you know, out-migration rates are not really that high, whether you look at it in seasonal terms, in long-term migration strategies, and so on. So even the relationship between poverty and migration is not as clear-cut, because Bihar and Kerala, the poorest and richest parts of India, have the same rates of out-migration. They're, of course, going to different places. Keralites are now mostly going to the Gulf. But that's interesting when you think of it, because then what we are saying is that Bihar will take like 20 to 30 years just to catch up with Kerala today. And there's no guarantee that that will stop out-migration. So I think the core factor binding what you asked and what I'm trying to say is population density. And that India's population has really, you know, there was a phase between the 60s and 90s when India's population grew extremely rapidly. And that has put a pressure on a lot of lands in different places. And so there's a natural pressure for people in especially the dense heartlands to move, whether there's a shock or not. And of course, when there's a shock, there's more of a reason. But you need to have that network in the city or in another, you know, a good destination site in order to pull you there.
And actually, just mentioned also sort of explain something that I think people have been sort of observing but not really talking about, because, and this is specifically relevant for Karnataka, because we have seen that the bulk of migration from rural Karnataka to Bangalore pretty much, happens from the relatively more prosperous southern and coastal districts, and very little from like almost Bihar level of development of North Karnataka districts. And but the population growth and at least the numbers seem to suggest that large numbers seem to be moving there. So which is, and that's a, because I think North Karnataka is also closer to Vidarbha in terms of development and poverty and so on. But it seems to me that like, you know, overall we're finding like larger migrations this way. But on that note, and I think this is something which sort of, it would be interesting to explore some more. And this is one point that you also make in your book. A lot of migration to urban areas seems to have happened historically from other urban areas, that relatively India's had very low rural to urban migration. I mean, you explore this a little bit in the book, but I wonder if we can discuss that a little bit more, that only now perhaps has it really picked up pace, but a lot of India's urbanization has taken place from people moving from smaller cities to bigger cities. And one explanation perhaps could be networks, but does network play such a great role that, you know, there is very little migration from rural to urban areas?
Yeah, I mean, let me rephrase that slightly. Of course, there's a lot of urban to urban migration, and the census of 2011 shows a staggering number. For the first time, that number is as large as, so rural to urban migration in India has always been greater than urban to urban migration. But that number of 80 million is now almost identical in 2011. So so actually this urban to urban migration story is more recent than the rural to urban migration story. But, you know, more generally, I mean, I make this distinction between short-term seasonal migration, which is really, you know, between 3 months, 6 months, and semi-permanent, permanent migration. And that's the core distinction to make. Because even if you take Bangalore, you know, the guys who are coming and settling in Bangalore are coming from relatively more prosperous regions, which means other cities for sure. And of course, you know, like coastal Karnataka and so on. It's not the case, you know, Raichur, Gulbarga is sending some people to Bangalore, but they're not settling down in Bangalore. They're coming in the construction sector. They're coming in sort of low pay sectors. They're staying for 2-3 months and going back. So there's this whole distinction between seasonal migration, where the poorest parts of India are overrepresented, and then there's semi-permanent, permanent migration, where the relatively richer parts of India are better connected. And not a district like Udupi was initially very, very poor 100 years back. Today, it's one of the richest districts of India. And it still has mass out-migration, but of a very different kind. So in, you know, 1890s, there were these laborers going for seasonal migrations, like you would see today in Raichur or Gulbarga. But today, that migration has completely stopped, because those guys have now become much better off, and they are moving in for much longer sort of duration. What's interesting for me, of course, is that this culture of migration picks up. So what you're going to see maybe in Raichur is that these seasonal migrations will transform into longer duration migrations. If there is some investment in Raichur and, you know, some average education levels go up, then you see this similar transformation in Raichur through migration that one saw in Udupi over the last 100 years.
Yeah, I think there's a paper that's circulating, Cosmopolitanism paper, which talks about the transformation of the changes in rural communities that come from migration to urban areas. I think it's written in the context of Tamil Nadu. You know, the migration that comes from prosperity versus the migration that comes from, you know, other circumstances. There is, at the destination of migration, that is in the city, as a starting assumption, you know, different ways of integration into what you can call as urban life and, you know, urban politics in that broader sense. And I'd love to understand a little bit more about some of the thinking in terms of how marginalities operate there. At least my own experience, and this is fieldwork based, has shown that the communities that migrate from the northern and the more disadvantaged parts of Karnataka, Hyderabad, Karnataka, and North Karnataka, are also backward castes. So they come from communities that already experience marginalization, both in the origin as well as in some ways the destination. And so how do...
I think one aspect of marginalization is where you locate yourself in the city. And that means space and sector. So these are the two sort of things. So there are clearly some sectors which in India which seem to be providing more upward mobility over time than others. For example, if you work in the brick kiln or construction sector, we know that the mobility is practically nil. If you work in garment knitting hubs in Tirupur or, you know, diamond polishing hubs in Gujarat, you can come with practically no skill and within a generation become a rich person. Right. So I think sector matters, sector specificity as to, some sectors just providing better opportunities to come up. And so that automatically leads to marginalization in one sense. But I think what you're saying is because cities, you know, starting from perfect segregation in villages, coming to a city and finding yourself in a segregated zone again, right? And so then automatically there is some marginalization because you don't have access to the same sort of facilities which many people living in the better parts of the city automatically tend to assume that they have. And I think that is a major penalty. That's a penalty in terms of travel cost because more and more people are living on the fringes of cities and working in the center, which means a lot of these poor migrant workers are spending a lot on travel, a lot of spending on food outside because you're just eating outside all the time. So that's the sort of economic marginalization which cities seem to be doing. I don't think it's a new thing. I think it's always been there, but maybe a bit new because travel costs to this, to work sites have increased tremendously. And that starts from the point that there's tremendous residential segregation in cities. And of course, I will still defend rural to urban migration in the sense that people often tend to think that, yes, there's marginalization in villages and marginalization in cities. And I completely agree with that. But I think you can talk about degrees of marginalization. And at least in terms of segregation, we know for a fact that the average village in India is got 100% segregation, right? I mean, clearly some castes live in the center, some castes live outside and so on. And cities, unfortunately, are similar, but it's much less. It's on relative terms that cities, I would argue, offer lesser marginalization. But the marginalization, you're absolutely correct. There can be social marginalization, which means why even if you want to rent a house, you don't get housing in the city that locks off so many people in today's cities of India. I mean, if you're Muslim and a migrant in a city, it's almost impossible to get housing in non-Muslim areas. And so automatic ghettoization, etc., takes place. And so marginalization works in different ways, but I think the core factors that drive it are space and sex.
Absolutely. I think the encounter of caste and marginalities that operate in rural areas is more complex in urban areas. Social networks operate to have indicators around caste. So the enforcement of boundaries is also longer term entrenched in that sense. Whereas here, in the absence of this kind of background information or those deep networks, it's harder to enforce it across and at all points of time. So ghettoization does have some kind of porosity, some kind of sort of, it's a negotiated space, not as perhaps hardline as it is in the rural areas.
Yeah, and I think the guy who really, you know, understood this was Ambedkar. And Ambedkar suffered from no illusion that, you know, migration will solve all your problems. But I think he saw very clearly on that some part of this anonymity, relative anonymity, is useful. And in the book, you know, I mean, there's some work now on Dalit entrepreneurship, for example, saying that what seems to work often, what anonymity confers is the ability to fail. You know, for entrepreneurs tend to fail often initially until they, you know, strike gold. And often if you fail in the place that you know, grew up in, then everyone makes fun of you saying, you know, why are you even trying out these new things? Just stick to your jobs that you've been doing for ages. But when you move to a setting where nobody really knows you, you can try out new things and, you know, I mean, you might fail once or twice, but then if you succeed, you can make it big. And so that's one of the things that, you know, studies are showing. But that comes to this big question on, you know, Gandhi versus Ambedkar's sort of perspective on rural to urban migration. And I should mention that Gandhi himself was not averse to migration, though he hated cities. But I quote Gandhi in the book saying, you know, he said that if there were atrocities being committed, then of course people should leave villages and go to the city. So he's on record saying that as well. But overall, definitely I would take personally on a normative sense, I would take the Ambedkarite view that migration, the anonymity sort of does liberate you to some extent. And we've done some field studies in the Konkan. And we're, you know, getting similar sort of ideas. It doesn't transform rural life in the sense, you know, say people go from the work class, going to the city and striking it big, helping their folks back home. We in the Konkan region study with Kalyani Vartak, where we saw that not much changes in the village, but the sense of identity has changed. So there's a lot more assertion of identity. Even though land holding sizes have not changed, there's some differences. And that's come about because of migration.
And moving on from rural to urban migration, and perhaps one migration which might have on going forward in terms of what might have large implications and something that we could discuss, we are seeing, of course, that there is this increasing divergence in the total fertility rate, or rather southern states and to an extent some of the eastern states have already slipped below the replacement level. That is, women in the childbearing years are having fewer than 2.1 children, which sort of suggests that population growth has pretty much plateaued. But we've seen that while the numbers have improved in the northern and the western states, they're still some way away from the hitting the replacement level. And what we are seeing is perhaps a demand for more labor coming from the southern and eastern states, and there being no immediate obvious barriers, there is probably going to be more migration from the northern states to southern and eastern states. And I wonder if this is something that is going to be an immediate political fault line in the future. And I don't just mean in the sense of, like, say, working class movement, I mean, in the sense that we're probably also going to see across various classes movement from the north to the south, possibly given the demand for labor, demand for people to move. And I wonder if that is going to lead to some sort of a political fault line in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that the migrations have already started to happen, and they will happen, and they will happen more and more, is mm-hmm. a given. So whether it can create a fault line, yes. I mean, obviously, you know, but it's about, I think it has already created fault lines, but I think with any anti-migrant sentiment, it's about whether or not a particular political party decides to make it an important agenda to contest elections on. And I come from the city of Mumbai, and I've, you know, grown up with political parties hell-bent on opposing migrants. And often it is purely on the basis of winning elections. In the sense, the minute the elections are over, the rhetoric dies down. So this is like any other sort of jingoistic sort of issue to rake up. You'll see that this happens usually in the big cities. You know, I mean, I don't think anti-migrant sentiments have usually come in smaller towns or villages, which means in the south, we're really talking of, I can think of only two cities, Bangalore and Chennai, in which this can happen. Hyderabad, I don't think can ever happen, because Hyderabad has a very different makeup. But I think Bangalore and Chennai, I think, and you in the past, you have had, you know, Kannada, Rakshakya, Vedike, it's still there. And there is that sort of sense. But as long as the economy is doing well, nobody really cares. I think usually anti-migrant sentiment picks up, especially even in Indian history, when the economy is, you know, starts faltering. And I think now is a classic case when the economy is not doing too well, when there's mass unemployment, that suddenly this is an issue which, you know, politicians can latch on. But I think north to south migration is an excellent thing for India as a whole, because south gets skills which it's in need of, and north gets money which is what it needs desperately. And so the migration being a classic sort of way to, you know, equilibrate two regions, I think this is a great thing. You're not going to see too much permanent migration, especially the labor migration. So this is still part of the Great Indian Migration Wave. It's semi-permanent. It's circular. And that's why, as I say, this the Great Indian Migration Wave moved eastwards towards Burma. You know, Rangoon was like the Dubai 100 years back. So it was Burma, Malaysia, Sri Lanka 100 years back. Then the Great Indian Migration Wave moved to the Persian Gulf. And in the 21st century, it's pretty much moving south. And it will eventually dry up. I mean, most out-migration streams, mass out-migration streams, tend to dry up as fertility falls. And so for the first time, you're seeing Kerala's numbers in the Gulf slow down. And that's not because the Gulf's economy is slowing or Kerala's economy is doing well. It's just because the pressure on population is now suddenly reduced tremendously. And so just like Europe needs immigrants, whether they like it or not, to sustain its population, its economy, the South is not, you know, as advanced on a demographic scale as Europe. Though some parts of Kerala are actually, you will need a lot of labor coming in from the north. I would also say you would also start seeing a lot of immigration, in the sense you'll see Nepali labor, which is already there in Ratnagiri, for example, moving down south as well. So it's not just north to south, there's also international north to south.
And that actually brings to a point, because in the week just before the recording of this episode, there has been news about the police here, quote unquote, cracking down on Bangladeshi migrants. The thing is, and as the migrants themselves have told everyone, even the police knew we were here for about 10 years. And there have been successive groups of people from Bangladesh who have come in and settled. And there was a very long piece about their lives. They're like, everyone knew it's here. It's just that they crack down upon us every 2 years or so just to show that they're doing things. But we are pretty much part of the city's economy. We do the jobs that no one else wants to do, and mostly in solid waste management, mostly in garbage collection and recycling. We do the kinds of jobs only nobody else in the city seems to want to do. So we are part of the economy. So yeah, we know this crackdown is just for show and things like that. So I guess that is sort of feeds into what you're also just saying, that we might see more of them. But there's one further point I just wanted to bring up before we move on. We've also seen a sudden spate in the last 12 months or so. And today, yesterday, for example, Karnataka also took this measure of jobs for locals and passing into legislation. So it's moved from the rhetoric into legislation. So we've seen Karnataka pass such a measure. We've seen Telangana pass such a measure. I think Andhra also had some measure in the works. And quite surprisingly, Madhya Pradesh, of all places. So I'm just wondering if this is like the beginnings of, well, maybe no one political party will take up this issue, but we may find that such responses are coming from government to at least appease some sort of local sentiment.
Yeah, so two things on that. I've written a piece in the Mint on that. One is, it's actually unconstitutional. I mean, if somebody files a court case against the government of Andhra Pradesh, for example, they will win this court case, there's no doubt. There has been a precedent of this and it was knocked down. So this is, I mean, it's just waiting for somebody to, you know, put their hand up and say it. So it's completely against freedom of movement in the country. You cannot simply, you know, reserve jobs for locals and so on. I mean, there has been precedent in this country of this, and there are clear precedents where people have won against the state. So I think this is a short-term thing. Maybe, you know, most states might do it. Andhra Pradesh started it this time around. But my guess is that it was quickly going to collapse. The second thing is, actually, if you see the numbers, you know, talking about like at least X percentage of jobs should be reserved for locals, actually the interstate migration numbers, especially for these states, are not that high. So which means is that the law is on paper, but it has no binding constraint, which means it doesn't matter whether you have the law or not. There's just simply not that many interstate migrants which can take away those jobs. So it's a lot of rhetoric to say that, you know, we're protecting jobs, but actually those numbers are meaningless. So there are two things. One is the laws are unconstitutional, but even if they are there, they have no bite and they're never going to be enforced per se.
And I think it's very performative in that sense, to signal to vote banks or to communities that something is being done about the influx of migrants.
Absolutely. I mean, as I said, you know, I've seen this for more than 25 years in Mumbai. So this is rhetoric after rhetoric after rhetoric. But the migration still continues and people are quite happy with, you know, people are coming and contributing to the economy.
And this is common in Karnataka too. And it's mixed with language chauvinism of this sort, which combined to create these kinds of legislations, or at least, you know, dharnas, protests and movements that... that are about removing migrants from the cities.
Yeah,
absolutely. I mean, the ultimate irony was, of course, when they made this movie on Bal Thackeray, the leading protagonist was Nawazuddin Siddiqui. And the question should have been, why were there no Maharashtrians? Yes. Because, you know, why could you not find one Maharashtrian to play the role? I mean, that would be the rhetoric.
So I think we are almost out of time. And I think on that note, we can sort of close this particular episode. Thank you, Chinmay, for joining us. This was a very interesting episode. We had a very fascinating discussion with you. For all our listeners, we'd once again recommend that you go out and buy Chinmay's book, India Moving. You can work your way through chapter after chapter. It's fascinating. It's filled with insights. And believe me, you will think very differently about a lot of issues related to migration and even marginalization in the context of India. So thank you once again, Chinmay.
Thanks a lot for having me.
It was lovely having you. And thank you everyone for tuning in to this episode of Ganatantra.
See you next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.